Anyway, I wrote a synopsis that you will be aghast and ashamed about because it's actually a decent synopsis. But yeah, otherwise,
Like when you do your synopsises, Derek, like Justin just hits the fast forward button, basically.
He's just like, you can't do that when it's live, motherfucker.
That's true. I wish I could zip through it.
Take it away, Derek. What's your question?
Why do you guys talk about comics so much?
Comic books.
Motherfucker, do you
read them?
18 years. Toothbrush is still fresh.
Did they have sex? Because, I mean, She-Hulk, you know.
Damn it, Tony. We went an entire episode without mentioning Maggot, and then you ruined it.
Comic books.
Motherfucker, do you
read them?
Batman's got his little fishbowl on his head, but Superman doesn't.
Cyclops was right.
Except when he was wrong.
Master Bruce, you are calm.
I'm going to silently judge all of you.
Shut up, beast. Shut up.
Like, I've read it so many times, you know, it pretty much just crumbled in my hands.
Come on, old chum.
Comic books.
Motherfucker, do you
read them?
See, I didn't hate Hellcat until you made me read this miniseries. It was just a joke, but you made it real, Justin.
No.
You made it real.
I prefer my Dazzler singing, like, Creedence Clearwater Revival songs at Australian bars.
Titty discs. And
that's what to be known as from now on. Like, I'm going to go into the Marvel Wikipedia and edit whatever it is.
The worst titty discs.
Doesn't get better than that.
Comic books.
Motherfucker, do you
read them?
Hey guys, welcome back to another shell-tastic, shellerific episode of Fanholes Comics. Motherfucker, do you read them? Hey, what's up, guys? This is Derek, Derek WC. I'm going to be one of your shellacking hosts tonight, but I am not alone. I am joined by two, count them, two of my fellow fan holes. Why don't you guys give a shout out and let everybody know who's here tonight?
Hey, it's Mike.
Hey, this is Justin.
Yeah, so on our list of anniversary celebrations that we thought would be fun to get together to talk about, it is the 40th anniversary of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, specifically the 40th anniversary of the very first issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was published by Mirage, came out May 1st, 1984, with the cover price of $1.50. Writer and artist Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird are doing the creative chores, and this was originally a larger black and white magazine edition when it first came out. I know I always brag about having like the magazine editions and stuff, and I know I had a magazine sized copy of number 4 in like a Mylar, which I thought was like super cool or whatever. But I think as far as like owning like issue 1, I think my avatar right now is the cover to the 5th print of issue 1, which was comic sized. And you know, I think at some point they stopped doing kind of like the magazine sized versions, and that included with the reprints or whatever. But anyway, much to Justin's chagrin, I have written an actual synopsis. I mean, I guess everybody knows the origin of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I feel like there's certain distinctions and discrepancies that get lost over the years. You know, everybody thinks they know, but there's certain details that take place in the actual first issue of the comic that have never really been truly adapted. So I just figure it's good to go through it anyway. So here we go. Cornered in a dark alley by the Purple Dragon Gang, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fight back against the gang using their signature weapons. Leonardo with his katanas, Donatello with his bow staff, Michelangelo with his nunchucks, and Raphael with his scythe. The dragons think they are a rival gang wearing masks and open fire with all their guns. All 15 dragons are cut down by the turtles. As police sirens encroach, the turtles strike hard and fade away into their sewer lair. Their master, a large rat named Splinter, congratulates them on their victory and finally reveals the tale of their origin after 13 years of ninja training. Originally, Splinter was a pet rat owned by his master, Hamato Yoshi. Splinter learned the ways of the ninja watching Yoshi from his cage. Yoshi was a member of the famous Foot Clan, the most feared warriors and assassins in all of Japan. His rival in the martial arts was Oroku Nagi, but what they competed for most fiercely was the love of a young woman named Kang Shen. Shen, however, loved only Yoshi, and Nagi beat Shen for refusing his affections. When Yoshi discovers his love Shen has been assaulted, he then kills Nagi in a blind rage. Shen and Yoshi fled to New York City, leaving behind Nagi's younger brother, Saki, who vowed vengeance. Soon, Oroku Saki led the New York branch of the Foot Clan and killed both Shen and Yoshi. Splinter's cage was smashed in the struggle, but although free, he wandered aimlessly, mourning his dead master. When a young man saves a blind man who is crossing the street from a large truck, a metal TCRI canister bounces free from the truck, striking the young man in the eyes, but also strikes a glass jar containing four pet turtles. The glowing radioactive ooze covers the turtles' bodies as Splinter follows them down the storm drain. The ooze not only doubles the size of the four turtles, but starts to make Splinter more intelligent and larger as well. Once the turtles start speaking, Splinter trains them in the art of ninjutsu and gives them all names of Renaissance painters:
Leonardo, Michelangelo, Donatello, and Raphael.
Splinter then asks his sons to avenge the deaths of his master and his wife by challenging and killing Oroku Saki, aka the Shredder. Raphael is tasked with delivering the challenge and breaks into the Foot Clan's compound, sending the challenge on a note wrapped around one of his sighs. The following night, the Turtles battle Shredder's best Foot Clan ninja and defeat them. When the Turtles come to attack Shredder one by one, they mostly fail to make contact, except for Leonardo. When the brothers attack together and strike using long-distance weapons, Leonardo manages to eventually stab Shredder in the chest. Instead of committing honorable seppuku, the Shredder sets off a thermite grenade to kill them all, until Donatello knocks Shredder and his grenade off the roof, with the explosion only enveloping the Shredder himself. Their mission finally accomplished, their master's master avenged, the Turtles head home. And that is the synopsis of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles issue number one. So, I feel like we've probably discussed this before, and I just don't remember or don't have the immediate recall. But is this something that you guys read first? Is this something that you read after watching the cartoon? Like, was it kind of in tandem? Like, do you guys have memories of all that kind of stuff?
For me, this was like way after, because I for me, the cartoon and the toys came first. And then I got into the Archie comics. And then I think I was maybe like 7th or 8th grade, and someone had maybe the first like collection of these issues. And I knew the Mirage stuff existed because I had seen the artwork, and I knew that it was very different from the cartoon and even the movie, but I had no idea like how different it was. So when I read it, it was a weird disconnect because I was so used to the cartoon. Like, that's I locked onto that because that's what came first to me. And it was one of those things that, like, the first time I read it, I was like, whoa, this is so weird. And I didn't appreciate it. Like, I just kind of thought it was like crude, and I was like, oh well, the cartoon and the Archie stuff, like, that's where it is, like, that's so much better. And then I got into high school and I read it again, and I was like, oh man, like, I was so wrong, like, this is really great. And then I had just a lot more appreciation for, like, the way it was made, because it was just two guys doing this. Like, they wrote it, they drew it together, and, you know, in interviews and in some if you read the, like, Ninja Turtles Ultimate Collection, it I think it collects like the first four or five issues, and it has, after each issue, it'll have like an interview with Eastman and Laird, and they'll kind of talk about the process and everything. And they kind of talk about how they just passed pages back and forth. Like, Eastman would draw something and ink it, and then Laird would draw something and ink it, and they just kind of like shared every page. Like, it wasn't just like Eastman drawing and Laird inking it. It's like they shared duties and they shared the writing and everything. And then when you think about how this was just like, this was just supposed to be like a one-off indie comic. Like, they borrowed a bunch of money and they printed like, what, like 500 issues or something. And they were like, yeah, we're going to be stuck with these for the rest of our lives. And then it became this huge thing and they had no idea. And so, like, when you, or at least when I became older and realized like the process of making comics and just how monumental it is to like, how monumental it is to like
create something and finish it and get it out there and people want it. Because like I was in high school and I'm sure all of us had ideas for comics that we wanted to make. You know, it's like, oh man, my character so-and-so, he'll be the greatest and I'm going to write it. My buddies can draw it. We're going to make $1 million. Like that's the dream, but that rarely ever happens. But these guys, they had the dream and they hit the jackpot. So I had a lot more appreciation for them, like having success. And then over the years, like I would revisit these early issues and I would see a lot of different things in it I like. Like I'm like, oh man, I was so stupid. Like the art, like I really like Eastman's and Laird's style in this. And I think there's a lot of pages and panels. I'm like, oh man, that's so cool. Like, I don't know. I guess it's just I was a dumb kid and I was so used to like polished stuff like Jim Lee or McFarlane or even like Mark Bagley or whoever like I was reading in a mainstream comic. Like I was so ingrained in that was so ingrained in my mind as what a comic book should be. And then you go to this and it's so like weird and different. And then it's in black and white. Like I think I had, Derek, you had that whole like coloring book thing. Like I kind of wonder how you like viewed this on your first reading. But I'm like, oh, I think I just was like, oh, this is crude. Like the stuff I'm liking is better. But then it's like I got older and kind of turned. I was like, oh man, like this is so much better. Like this is so much more mature and creative and everything. And it's kind of like, oh well, the stuff I liked as a kid was fine, but it was very safe and diluted and kid friendly. And you kind of like. You know, as you grew up, you're like, okay, I get it. I get what's going on. But, like, both have their merits. And I think that's where I'm at right now. Like, the stuff I grew up on, like the toys, the cartoon, the Archie comics, like, that stuff is great. I love that. But I also love this because it's so, it has its own different style and flavor. And in those interviews, Eastman and Laird say, like, their two biggest influences were Jack Kirby and Frank Miller. And then they also kind of, like, used Dave Sims service as like kind of a guidepost or something because like as at the time service was getting pretty big and they were like, oh, maybe we could do our own little service thing, and they kind of used that. And I've been slowly reading service, like I've just barely got out of the whole barbarian phase, but I do kind of see like a lot of like early service reflected in this now too.
Yeah, that seems to be something that, everybody, I don't know, looks to other people for inspiration, or maybe they set a goal post, right? And they say, oh, well, if, for me, like, I know you brought up like, having notions of, oh, I can create superheroes or I can do stuff. And I think the early on there was a part of me that was kind of like, oh, well, anything I do is going to be heavily influenced by what I like and maybe a poor imitation of that. So I was hesitant to do it. And I think it's probably funny to say now, but if anything like convinced me to get over that, it was like the Image exodus, and specifically I feel like Rob Liefeld, Cause I was like, well, if he can go around and make, pastiche versions of Superman called Supreme, I could make my own pastiche version of Superman too, and it's fine. Like there's nothing wrong with it or whatever. And so like that was always something that, helped make me move forward with messing around with doing stuff like that. And probably, like you're saying, the same thing applies to, if Dave Sim can have this success with Cerebus, like we can try to have our own success with these turtles, right? And, what kind of blows me away about it is that, it's, in some ways, it's like it was a one-off satire, like it was a gag. It was like, as much as it's influenced by Frank Miller, it's also kind of making fun of Frank Miller. I mean, what's funny is everybody like, what was it? Oh, it was like, I guess because I've been listening to all these Daredevil retrospective podcasts lately, like, the Rolled Spine guys did their anniversary podcast on Daredevil. And then, Shag did one with J. David Weider, Once Upon a Geek. And there was some commentary, at least on the first one, about, how come they never use the hand in any of these Daredevil movies? And I don't know if it's just, they're not connecting the dots or, but ironically, Turtles was a popular film cartoon franchise long before Daredevil was even I mean, yes, they tried to get Daredevil off the ground a number of times as maybe a film or a television property or something like that before the Turtles were a thing, but it never really took off, right? And because of that, the thing that was on everybody's minds was the Foot Clan. And I think that's the answer. That's why Daredevil's never really touched the Hand. Because the Foot is the joke version of the Hand, but
yeah.
Much like I mean, if I was going to be that guy, you know, the guy that rants and raves about The Incredibles is not a Fantastic Four movie and screams and yells about it, it's like, you know, you could do the same thing and go, oh, the Foot Clan is not the Hand, you should still do the Hand, right? But the problem is, to all those Larrys, like, you can't have too many blue guys in the same movie. You know, it's the same idea, like, oh, all they know is this Foot from the Turtles thing. Like, we can't do the Hand. That's incredibly stupid. Like, they're going to laugh at us. And really, it was the other way around, right? Like, in comics, everybody knew what the Hand was, and it was supposed to be super serious ores. And then the gag of it is, well, these guys are the Foot Clan, you know, and even in the origin, right? I mean, that it all sort of paints a picture and puts its inspiration on its sleeve, I guess, right? I mean, like, you know, the commentary that, like, oh, Daredevil's literally in their origin, you know, like, Daredevil's the one pushing the guy out of the way of the truck and gets hit in the eyes, just like Matt Murdock does, you know, and then the canister hits the Turtles. So then you have this funny thing where you're like, wait a minute, the Outram made Daredevil? Like, what? Like, you know, like you can't really do it in reverse, but like, those are the kind of things where, you know, that kind of stuff like hits you smack dab in the face or whatever. But I don't want to hoard or hog up all the talking and stuff. What about you, Mike? Like, how did you, I mean, was there an order in which you first came to this? Like, was this something that you came to after the cartoon? Like, how did you sort of come upon this actual, you know, origin story for the Turtles?
Yeah, like, I think my order was probably the cartoon, the first movie, then some Archie comics, then this, I think, probably. Like, so, like, and, like, I don't know, my memories of that time are pretty, you know, vague and, like, scrambled, but, like, I think, like, I feel like I was already trained at the time by, like, Transformers to realize that the comic and the cartoon were two different things, and then, like, Turtles, it was, like, three things. It was, like, the comic, the cartoon, and this, like, you know, and the movie, and then, like, you know, it was four things, actually.
And the Archie comic.
The Archie, right? Yeah. So it's like, I saw the cartoon, I saw the first movies, I got some Archie comics, and then, like, my distinct memory of first coming to the original Mirage, like, Turtles, is going into a Kmart with my parents, and, like, going to their book section, and, you know, as usual, like, you know, I was, like, probably 7 or 8, and, like, back then, it's like, you know, parents didn't, like, you know, there was, like, you know, it was a different time, so my mom and dad would be like, hey, stay in the book aisle, like, don't go anywhere, you know, and we're gonna do our shopping. So, like, they left me alone, basically, in the book aisle, and, like, I would, like, you know, read stuff, and what I found there was, like a few collections of the first, like, Mirage Turtles,
yeah.
And, like, I like, you were trying to help me before the show started, like, figure out, you know, which ones they were, and I think they're the ones you showed me, like, the ones, like you said, like, you got them at, what, Walden Books? Or
yeah, I got mine at Walden Books. Like, the ones that I was thinking of, they were published by First, and that was a company that published a lot of comics, but they had these collections, and this is also kind of an answer to Justin's question, is that these are the ones that I gravitated towards the most when I was a kid. And not that I didn't go and hunt back issues of the Mirage comics where they were in black and white, because I did. I absolutely did. But to answer your question of what was Derek, you know, coloring book Derek's reaction to black and white, you know, Ninja Turtles comics was to lap up and love to death these first graphic novel collections, because they were all done in color.
Oh,
so and yeah, so that was, well, that, like, was kind of what I gravitated towards.
Like, I know the first two collections were there, and I desperately, like, I Leonardo was always like, you know, my favorite turtle, and he was at this point. And like, I think it's the second collection that has the issue. Like, is that the Leonardo like one shot or spotlight where he fights all like the army of foot and like it's like thrown through the window?
I think so, because that would be, well, I'm trying to think, because the first collection, at least for the first one, it reprints like the first like three or so issues, and then I think they keep doing three issues at a time. So I think it would be maybe the third one, because it's like they have to do the turtles in space and the triceratons and all that other stuff, so they don't do the return to New York stuff. Let me see, 3, 6, 9. I mean, I almost wonder if they didn't get to it until the third or the fourth.
It must have been like one of the third or the fourth ones, because I distinctly remember reading that issue in that Kmart like book aisle or whatever. So like then that, and like I remember I desperately like wanted my parents to buy it, but I guess it wasn't like a buying day for me, so like I had to leave it behind. So I was like all like, you know, butthurt over that as a 7 or 8 year old or whatever. But like I don't know if I had the reaction Justin had. Like I was so like obsessed with turtles at the time that I was like, I thought like everything was cool. Like even though I acknowledged it was all different, I was like, oh man, like this is like, I didn't exactly know this was like the original turtles. I think like I just thought like, oh man, like this is like, it might be in black and white, but this is like way like, you know, more action packed, cool.
It's book four that has the Leonardo one shot. Uh-huh. So, and the cover of this doesn't look very red, but it's that fourth volume, because it says here in my comic shop, it says like it does memory... 10, 11, and the Leonardo one shot, which makes sense.
I think, like, I'm looking at the covers, and I think book two is the cover I remember, but it's probably book four that I, like, remember reading, like, and being obsessed with because of that Leonardo issue. But I mean, speaking to this issue that we're talking tonight, like, I know the first volume was definitely there, and I know that's the first time I read this issue was in that collection. And yeah, like, I mean, I read the Archie comics, and like Justin said, I was kind of like, you know, oh, like this is kind of like the Archie comics are like the cartoon, but these like black and white things seem more like the movie. So like, you know, I thought all of it was cool. And, you know, I think I took that collection to my mom and dad and, you know, said, you know, can I get this? And, you know, how much was it then? Like $10.99 or something? Or I forgot what. Yeah. Then they were like, no, it's not a buying day. Like, Michael, like, put it back. Like, I'm like, oh, like. So, and then I don't think I ever saw it again. So like, I was always kind of mad about that. And then I don't think I ever recovered it again until like, you know, my interest in turtles was like done for the time being. Like, so I, you know, when I went back, like, you know, several years later and started rereading all the original Mirage comics, I'm like, oh yeah, like this is how this all, like I when I had a better understanding and picture of the, like, you know, the big picture or whatever of how everything fit and stuff, I was kind of a lot more appreciative of, like Justin said, gaining an appreciation for the original, like, you know, gritty adult, like, you know, stuff like that. I was a little more mature and I could like understand why it was different and why it was more like adult. So, yeah.
I mean, I think like yourselves, I mean, the first thing I encountered, I'd say, are the, you know, was the 5-part Turtles cartoon and the toys. And then I think after that, I, you know, was able to pick up on, oh, look, there are Archie comics and there are Mirage comics. And I think by then I was mostly, I mean, you know, I still was getting things off the spinner rack here and or there. But I think by that point, like, whether it was like, I don't know, 88 or 89, you know, something like, you know, kind of right around, you know, right before Batman 89 took off, I had discovered comic book specialty shops. So I was buying, you know, back issues of Silver Surfer, where, you know, where I had started from the spinner rack and things like that, and, you know, hunting whatever it was. And I remember the first Mirage comics, I think I bought off the from the specialty shop stands, were when Rick Veitch was doing his, you know, doing that leech sheriff thing. You know, it was kind of like super weird and everything, I thought, but I bought those and they were in black and white. And I kind of quickly learned, like, oh, that, you know, the Walden Book stuff had the collections in color. And then I was able to get some back issues that were in black and white. And I sort of started piecing together. Like, I didn't have a complete run of the Mirage, like, black and white Turtles. But, like, the Return to New York I thought was really cool. Like, you know, the Triceraton stuff, because I love Triceratops. Like, I would, you know, pick and choose certain issues. And because the Triceraton was under the sewer in that Return to New York thing, I think I gravitated towards that. And I saw that that was when the Shredder came back. So, you know, it was like those were the things I sort of tried to hunt down. And I know, like I said, I know I had the fifth printing of number one and I had the first printing of number four. And then after that, like I think I jumped into 9, 10, and 11 because that was the Return to New York and everything. And then I think there, you know, there was some spottier missing, you know, links in my reading of Turtles. And then when I found those first color editions, then it was like great because it was like having a Marvel masterwork, only it was, you know, spread out over like, you know, four volumes or whatever. So I was able to read, you know, the first 10 issues of Turtles and that whole kind of thing. And I guess my order, I don't know, I'm trying to like frame it in such a way, like I think my, you know, my order was the cartoon and the toys and then the Mirage books and Archie books almost at the same point, because I mean, I don't know, I'd have to look at the dates, but like my memory of the Archie books was I sort of vaguely remember the limited series that reproduced the first five episodes of the cartoon. And I think the first time I like picked up an issue of the ongoing Archie book, it was when, you know, the big giant space cow head was like teleporting them around and it was like Raphael got dumped into that pit, so he looked like he was either stealth Raphael, or the politically incorrect term is like tar baby Raphael or whatever, but like that was what I remembered the most, was like that arc where they all kind of had their own unique looks or whatever, and maybe to even further distinguish them in that comic or whatever. And so like, you know, and then I watched the film, which to me was, you know, super awesome, because by then, you know, I had read Return to New York, I had read the first issue, like I knew all that stuff backward and forward. So to me, I was like, oh wow, like they're not just doing the, you know, like I guess at that point maybe I was getting a little too snobby for the cartoon or whatever, you know, at that point I was kind of like, oh, this isn't the cartoon bullshit, like this is the hardcore, like, you know, Raphael saying damn and they're getting into fights and this is like for really reals and stuff, and I thought it was really cool. Whereas it's funny, like now I'm looking at some of it kind of going like, oh well, some of this is certainly a satire, right? It's like it's kind of it's that, you know, in some ways the gag is like they're talking as hardcore as Wolverine in a Claremont Miller Wolverine miniseries, but the joke is they're a fucking turtle. Do you know what I mean? Like that's the joke, right? Like that it's kind of like this ludicrous imagery, but yet I feel like it held up. It's almost like it held up over the test of time to where like that's almost irrelevant. Like the satire or the gag. It's almost like at this point with like, you know, your Hellboys and your, you know, all kinds of craziness that people see in comics on a day, you know, whatever it is, Lori Lamaris is a mermaid, you know, like whatever it is that people have been there, seen it, done it, you know, at this point, the fact that there's walking, talking turtles that, you know ninjutsu, like it's almost like, yeah, it's just another, you know, another thing that people are like, yeah, cause it's comics, you know, like that's why it is. And you almost that satire aspect, it's part of the recipe, but it's like it's very subtle. It's like, you know, just a little ginger, a little spice, a little whatever it is in your recipe, but it's not so overwhelming that like you take a bite out of it and you're like, oh, there's way too much salt in this loaf of bread or what, you know, whatever it is, right? It's like whatever it is, it's just right, you know, like just the right amount of, you know, satire, so that basically by now people barely notice it. And when you come back and read this again, like what you actually gravitate toward too is like the Miller-esque Daredevil-ishness of it, you know, that kind of like gritty hardcore kind of like, you know, he comes at me, I come at him, but I come at him harder. You know, like that kind of, you know, like the manly man narration talk, you know, that like Raphael has, or, you know, whoever it is that is like, you know, kind of narrating at any given moment. And that's what seems to sort of like, you know, hold up over the test of time, at least for me. Like, I mean, it's like this is one of those things, like, you know, I mean, it's a classic comic, and you can easily just, I mean, you know, I don't know, for me, it's not something I can like overanalyze or anything. It's just something you can easily get lost in and find yourself getting lost in. Like, just like if you're watching the movie and you get captured when Splinter starts telling the origin, it's like the same thing here, but in comic form. It's like, you know, he's like, I will sit down and I will tell you a story, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to sit down and listen to your story, Master Splinter, you know, and it, you know, for me, the stuff that's interesting is like, you know, the discrepancies of like, oh, you know, it's not, you know, it's the movie tries to sort of like movies always do. They try to aim at the lowest common denominator and streamline so that it's very simple. There's less characters to cast. It's not, you don't have to make too many leaps. It's just, oh, there's a guy, there's another guy. They have a fight over a girl. And then now the guy wants vengeance or whatever. Like, it's like they don't deal with this whole, oh, there's a guy, another guy, they both love the same girl. The guy killed the girl or tried to kill the girl. And then the guy kills the guy that tried to kill the girl. And now the younger brother kills the guy and the girl. And now the rat's telling them to go hunt down the guy that killed the guy and the girl. You know, like, and I could see why, you know, like in a movie scenario or even a Saturday morning cartoon scenario, like that part gets stripped or horribly cut out of the backstory. But like just being able to sort of revisit it here, you're like, oh, you know, there's a lot more, I don't know, the nuances of stuff where it's like sometimes like you get so, I feel like we've had the turtle story told to us so many times through all the different cartoon series, through all the different movie incarnations, like you almost forget. You're like, Oroku Nagi, who's that? You know what I mean? Like, and you go, oh yeah, like they don't really go into Oroku Nagi all that much. It's always Oroku Saki, you know, like, and, you know, it was like, and that was the thing that blew me away the first time I saw the movie. Cause I went, oh shit, they're not doing the cartoon. It's not that Hamato Yoshi turns into a rat. It's that the rat learns the martial arts from Hamato Yoshi in his cage, you know, like, and it's like the fact that they just went whole hog and committed to that, you know, in the film, and that this was part of the original, you know, first issue, that was what always sort of blew me away about those particular interpretations. Like the more faithful they were to the source material, those were the things that I always used to fall in love with when there were adaptations that they, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, there was no costume shame. They weren't embarrassed by the source material. And the fact that, like, I mean, I think people missed the point that, like, some of this was parody. It was satire of stuff that was epically great in comics, you know, that Daredevil run that Miller did, you know, it's like that's always going to be something that everybody points to. And it's funny how, like, it's, you know, it's been 40 years, right? And it feels like, you know, in some ways the Turtles are way bigger than Daredevil will ever be in some regards, right? And in other regards, maybe that's not true at all. But the fact that they've sort of eclipsed the thing that they were satiring, like, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I mean, I do feel like in some ways that somehow gets, I don't know, swept under the rug or lost between the weeds, or like people just don't, you know, it basically, if you were going to say to the grandmas that all know who Iron Man is now that didn't know who Iron Man was, like, you know, 20 years ago, like, oh, by the way, like, Daredevil is the little boy who pushes the guy out of the way, and their origins are intertwined, the Daredevil and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I think most people, including all those grandmas, would be like, who's the burn victim? Like, I don't get, what are you talking about? Like, it'd be this giant revelation to them or something.
I just remember, like, those Archie comics you describe. Like, you know, I think I told this story on the first, like, Turtle show we ever did. But, like, I had an audio cassette with, like, a bunch of those, like, comics that, like, you know, had voice acting for all those characters. So, like, I remember, you know, the Turtles got swallowed up by, what's his name, Cowlick or whatever, and dumped in that intergalactic, like, wrestling match or whatever. So, and Leatherhead was there, and, like, when he beat up Ace Duck, and he said the line that still, like, is burned into my memory is, better a leather head than a feather head.
I mean, I didn't revisit this for the purpose of the show, but the, you know, given the level of, I guess, grit and violence, you know, blood, you know, the eye for an eye nature of this first issue, it's like Flinner's like, they killed my master and his wife. Like, now you will go out and issue a challenge and kill the Shredder. And you know, just at how hardcore it was. And, like, seeing that comparison done in Turtles Forever, you know, like the because it's like you had the 2K3 Turtles who were kind of like, who are these cartoon idiots or whatever, but then seeing, like, the black and white Turtles go, you guys are all a bunch of pussies, you know, like, and it's like, and then they kind of go, whoa, like, now they know how it feels to get called out, you know. And it's like that kind of stuff is always funny to me, you know. And it does, you know, it was something that was, like, incredibly, I feel like, was super true to this era of the Turtles.
I love that,
you know.
I love when Donatello is like, why are they narrating out loud? Like, are they insane? Like, but yeah, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, super gritty. Like, I don't think until I, like, read it somewhere, I don't think I even, like, you know, caught the Daredevil references or any of the parody things. Like, I took this, like, you know, deadly, like, I think I read this before I read anything that this was parodying.
I think that's probably true for a lot of people. I mean, whether it's how they were exposed to it, like through movies or cartoons or whatever, I think that's true for a lot of people. So to some people, you know, it has that versatility, like, and you know, don't laugh, but, you know, and I know you guys aren't, but to me, it had that same versatility that Batman 66 always had for me, like, where you watched it when you were, like, 5 years old and you took it deadly seriously, like, oh, Batman's pulling out his fucking bat shield and it's bulletproof, and this is, and he's narrowly avoiding the atomic pile, and this is, like, life or death and everything, and you took it all, like, super seriously. And then, you know, maybe when you're, like, 15 or 16, you laughed your ass off about the fucking, you know, the fucking plastic shark, right, the rubber shark or whatever, and then you know, maybe, you know, 15 years after that, you know, you kind of go back to appreciating it again, going, damn, I want to get some milk and cookies with Miss Kitka, like, hell yeah, you know, like, so it's like it goes back and forth or whatever. But I feel like this also has that same versatility where you can sit there and take it super seriously and not know when it's referencing, and then kind of enjoy the goofiness of whatever cartoon interpretations there are, and then come back to this again and kind of go, oh man, this is like, not only is this a good comic, but it's also, like, sort of an excellent satire and parody, you know what I mean? Like, it really walks that tightrope to where it can just be its own thing for people who don't have the information or don't have the insight or whatever, and is just an enjoyable story on its own. But if you happen to know the inspiration for it and all the nuances behind it, then it you know, it makes it an even more, you know, it makes it more concrete, its place in comic history.
It is interesting coming back and reading this after having watched the newest movie, Mutant Mayhem, which I don't think you guys saw that, did you?
Mm-mm.
Okay, mini review. I liked it. It was fun and funny. But going to that and coming back to this, it's like reading Frank Miller's Year One and then watching, like, you know, Adam West Batman. It's like, it's night and day. Mm-hmm. Like, it has a little bit of that whole, like, Roy Thomas, like, when you get so far removed from, like, the Thor source material, is it still Thor? Because, I mean, it's that movie is, like, it has this really unique animation style, and it's, you know, super bright and, you know, funny and loud noises and loud colors and everything. And it's like the antithesis of this. And there's also, like, weird character beats and choices, because in that movie, like, Splinter doesn't teach them anything. Like, they learn ninjutsu from like watching YouTube and movies and mimicking what they see, which I don't know, like I get it, like that's, it's like a thing that's of the moment of right now, right? That's like, oh, the, like Larry, the kids, what are they like? Oh, they watch the YouTubes and streaming and influencers, like that's what the kids like. Okay, well that's how the turtles like learn their moves. I'm like, to me, like as a, you know, an old, you know, old fuck and grumpy, I'm just, like that just seems so weird and wrong. And like, well, they're not really ninja turtles then, are they? Are they? They're just like pretenders because Splinter didn't teach them shit. So going from that movie back to this, where like Leonardo stabs the Shredder, like I'm like, oh, this is so like you're saying, I can appreciate both, but when you go from one to the other, like from one extreme to the other, you're just like, wow, it's so bizarre almost that those two different things can exist from one property almost. I don't know. It just, it's, I find that weird and also fascinating.
I feel like I could write like, you know, a
50-page thesis paper
dissertation yeah. on why not only those discrepancies, but like why Leonardo gets the short shrift in like all forms of media of the turtles, and then start talking about, you know, Cyclops and Prowl and, you know, just all these characters where you're like, oh no, these guys are the man. But then it's like they get this, you know, I don't know, this whitewashed version of their media history where like Raphael gets all the good Leonardo parts from the Mirage comic in the films, or you know, just the notion that like, oh wait, like, you know, Leonardo not only does he get the first like blood cut on Shredder, whereas nobody else could, like he also like is able to see, like, you know, it's like that whole, what do they call it? Like when, you know, the either the samurai or the gunfighters, you know, they stare each other down and the fight's decided in that split second where they're staring each other down. And it's like that thing of like, oh, I can't beat him on my own. But if we all gang up on him, you know, if we go gangster on Shredder and we all attack him from a distance, then after that, like maybe we can take him out. And then even in the original movie where it's like Splinter has to, you know, it's interesting because it's like it's that notion of like, you know how they're always talking about how the sins of the father get passed on to the sins, you know, to the son or whatever, but it also is like, you know, this isn't like a sin thing, but it's like, you know, basically he's charging these 15-year-old kids with, you know, my, you know, it's like my master was killed by the, you know, the younger brother of the man he killed, and I cannot do, like, even though Splinter in this story learned the ways of ninjutsu, he's old enough to the point where it's like, I've passed along my teachings, but I'm, you know, I mean, you almost get the vibe, like it's funny, it's that weird Professor X dissertation that you have to write, where it's like, presumably Professor X at the end of every issue of X-Men should be able to mind zonk everybody, you know, take all their money at the Vegas casinos, like we always joke about, and just call it a day. And that's what he does in like the first, you know, 20 issues of X-Men. He just fucking mind zaps everybody by the end of the issue. But if you look at it to the point where if Splinter is so old at this point that all he can do is pass on his teachings, his knowledge, and you apply that kind of logic to Professor X as well, right? It's like he can't go mind zonking people for the rest of his life. He can only pass on what he knows to his students and hope that they take his teachings and run with them. It's the same idea, right? Like the turtles have been trained to enact vengeance on Shredder, but you never get the idea that like Splinter can do this himself. I mean, even in what the second issue, it's like, doesn't Splinter get like pwned by the fucking Mousers and they think the Mousers evade him? So it's like, yes. It's like that's kind of built into the, like, it's like Professor X and Splinter get sort of amalgamated with the Aunt May trope. And even though they're like the bestest when they were young and in their prime, they have that Aunt May syndrome of they could fucking, you know, have a heart attack at any fucking minute also. So it's like, they're not going to be the ones that, they're too old to rise to the charge of taking care of this. And the only way that they can continue fulfilling that mandate, you know, honoring their master, is to just train the next generation to you know, help them take care of this shit. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's a funny idea, but the way this ends is so different from how the movie ends, where, you know, you can tell, like, filmically, they want that return to, like, oh, Splinter has to be there at Shredder's demise. Whereas in this, it's like, he doesn't have to be there. All that has to happen is Shredder needs to fucking get killed. Do you know what I mean? And you imagine at the end of it, they're supposed to come home and just be like, hey, Master Splinter, we took care of this shit. Bitch is dead. And then they find, you know, the Mousers have, you know, kidnapped them, and they go off and have more adventures. But if there were no more adventures and this was the final thing, you'd imagine they'd all just come home and hang up their scythes and their katanas and say, hey, we did what you asked. Like, now we can go out and watch YouTube videos and be teenagers again. You know, like, but we've
go
now
kill,
fulfilled.
Go kill Shredder. I must watch my stories.
Yeah, I gotta watch my stories. I'm too old for this shit.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, you said, like you said, it's kind of, you know, it was intended as a parody. So, I mean, like, they probably didn't, like, you know, expect it. Well, you know, it wasn't designed to, like, go on, you know, until they decided to do that. So.
Right, right. And I think it speaks to it that, you know, I think the initial thing was, oh, this is going to be a one off. It's going to be hilarious. Like, yes, we fulfilled our dream, but I don't know that the dream was to, you know, have a Cerebus sized run, you know, like make an announcement like Dave Sim, where I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life type thing or whatever. Right. And then when it took off and was popular, then it was like, oh, OK, well, we can do more of these. We can do this again. And like Justin was saying, it's almost the dream, right? Like, this is, I mean, I know people kind of mock and make fun of it these days because, I don't know, to be honest, it is quite mockable and laughable. But, you know, the notion that, like, all these people that are in comics right now aren't really in comics for the love of comics. They're just in it to get a Netflix deal. And, like, unfortunately, like, kind of like how people are always talking about, you know, comics learned the wrong lessons from Alan Moore's Watchmen, or learned the wrong lessons from Miller's Dark Knight Returns. I mean, I feel like comic creators or the generation of comic people now, like, maybe they learned the wrong fucking lesson from Eastman and Laird. I mean, and it's funny too, because you can see, like, this whole, you know, torrid history of, you know, it's funny too, because you're like, oh, it was the dream, but, like, it seems like at some point the dream becomes to just sell it all, you know, like kind of like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I feel like sometimes people feel betrayed by this in the long run, but, like, you know, the idea that, like, Jim Lee eventually, and it's like Jim Lee branched out from Marvel, did Image, made all of his own characters, but then eventually sold it all back to DC, you know, like, and I think there's some people that feel, like, betrayed by that, like, that he's not still out there just doing, I don't know, Wildcats or whatever, right? You know, Authority or Stormwatch or whatever those characters, you know, that he, you know, he created or had a hand in creating himself. And it's like, if you look at, like, Eastman and Laird, like, you know, it was like, that was the dream, right? They not only did they make a comic that was a parody that took off, that they, like Justin said, it's a monumental task. Just the one issue came out, but then they continued to make issues. They licensed it and sold it, and it became this extremely, like, it was, you know, just this monumentally popular, you know, cartoon. It sold toys, it sold video games, it sold posters, it sold t-shirts. It became this bonanza thing. Like, this just blew up and became this, you know, multimedia pop culture sensation. Like, and not really overnight, but it felt like it was overnight. And all that momentum and popularity and everything, you thought at the back of it, oh, if their idols were, you know, Jack Kirby and Frank Miller, well, guess what? They weren't going to end up like Jack Kirby and Frank Miller, where nobody recognized them or they didn't get cuts of, you know, whatever, you know, corporate comics they worked on when they finally got around to making a movie out of whatever it was that they did. Like, they got all the money up front because they own that shit, right? And you're like, oh, well, isn't that the dream? Like, that's what all these these quote unquote kids doing comics now are like, oh, I want the Netflix deals. Like, I want to be, I mean, to me, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, they just want to be Eastman and Laird. But then, like, I think, you know, now we've had what, like 40 years of, you know, history with that. And then you see like, oh, wait, like they're still essentially like what they're known for is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But then what, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't have the math in front of me, but when did they sell it back to Nickelodeon? Like 2008, 2010? Like how many years has it been owned by Nickelodeon now?
Yeah, probably 9 or 10 maybe.
Yeah, right. So almost of this 40 years, that, you know, 30 of it were quote unquote living the dream, you know, like, you know, where people didn't feel betrayed or whatever, you know, I'm just making that up. Or saying maybe some people feel that way. I'm not saying I feel that way, but you know, the fact that they were living the dream outside of corporate comics. But at some point it's like that George Lucas shit. I mean, George Lucas was quote unquote living the dream too. And eventually he sold to Disney. So it's like, I mean, you know, it's like at some point you either cash out while you can, while you're alive to do it, or, you know, at some point you die and then what, your heirs hopefully cash out. I mean, I think the idea is maybe you cash out while you have control of it to cash out so that nothing crazy. I mean, I don't think we've lived long enough. I mean, I could be wrong, but like, I feel like we haven't lived long enough to see something that was like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that was a massively popular IP bonanza that not only did it last long enough and retain its popularity long enough to outlive its creator, but I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong, Justin. Like, maybe you can come up with something. But like, is there some property you can think of where the property outlasted the creator, and then the heirs, like somebody's son or daughter, sold it to some corporate company or something? I mean, it might be a trick question, right? Because I can't think of anything like that. Like, I mean, I feel like we've lived long enough to see guys that own their own stuff sell it back to corporations, right? But it's like, I can't think of like, it's like, did Sarah Frazetta sell something back to, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I don't even know that I know enough people's lineages to make that claim. But it's like, you know, it's one of those things where you think about it and you're like, oh, well, who owns... You know,
I'm trying to think of who owns all the Tarzan rights, because when Edgar Rice Burroughs died, I think his son, John Coleman, owned everything. But I don't know who owns everything now. Like, I know there's Burroughs Incorporated, but I don't know if that's family run or not. Like, I know they're very protective. Like, you know, anytime there's anything
that's like being Dynamite. Done with it.
Yeah, they're very protective, but I don't know if that's family run or if it's just, you know.
Is any of the Robert E. Howard stuff still family run?
No.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess I can't. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know enough about it, but I feel like that's something that's, you know, I guess in terms of the legacy of this and the, you know, the fact that we're talking about this, like, you know, it's 40 years old, right? Like, that's something that I don't know that I tend to, I don't know, percolate on or whatever. It's like, because then you've got this stuff where it's like, oh, Mickey Mouse is going back into the public domain, you know, like all this kind of, you know, stuff that's going on. It's like, well, eventually, maybe that's part of it too, right? Like at what point does Star Wars and Turtles and all that shit become worthless? You know what I mean? Like maybe they're the bright ones. You know what I mean? Like, maybe Jim Lee is smarter than all, you know what I mean? Like maybe that's the thing. Like, if Mickey Mouse is going to get, you know, turned into the public domain, maybe the smart move is, oh, cash out before that happens so that you don't have like, Winnie the Pooh slasher movies being made with Spartan and the fucking Wildcats, you know, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like I don't, you know, I mean, that's something where it's tough for me to do mental gymnastics, but it's like, I'm just thinking of this on the fly. Right. And kind of going, oh, maybe that's part of the equation that I'm not even considering until I just thought of it, you know, like, so, you know, I don't know.
I do know that when they sold to Nickelodeon, like, Laird had a proviso put in place where, like, if he wants to do his own like Ninja Turtles comic, he can, like, because he never finished his, I think it's volume 4, like he never finished
okay.
it.
Okay.
So he has the right, like if he wants to do his own Turtles comic, like if he wanted to finish volume 4, which every now and then he kind of talks about it, but I don't, you know, I feel like it's like George R. R. Martin,
Martin
gonna finish Game of Thrones. Like I think he just likes to toy with the idea, and he's, you know, he probably doesn't have it in him to do a whole issue like every, you know, few months or whatever. But he has that proviso.
I feel like I could throw stones at myself with this. I was thinking about this the other day because I was like, you know how I'm always talking about, you know, oh, when they do, you know, what if Claremont had kept writing the X-Men? Oh, well, we're going to do X-Men forever. But then I always kind of say, well, this is like 15 years later. So it's not quite what it would have been had he been doing it at the time. And sometimes I think to myself, can you, like, I was like, what if in some weird fringe alternate reality, like I won the lottery and I didn't have to like work for a living and all I did was do History of Comics on Film videos? Like those videos would be way different from the videos I make that are like spread out over a year or 4 years or, you know, however long it takes me to do them, because I've changed. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, and you know, it's kind of like, you're always fond of talk. You're like, oh, Derek fucking hates everything now. And it's like, well, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, it's a joke, but it's not, right? Like, it's like one of those things where it's like, I'm not, I don't have the same passion for, you know, adaptations to film and or cartoons that I once did. And because of that, it's like, I think in some ways that had either slowed me down or, you know, certainly colors like how I'm viewing certain things, you know. And it's a lot easier to just shoot the shit about it on a podcast than it is to devote, you know, hours and hours and days of, like, you know, script writing and editing and all that other stuff to get those points across, you know. But sometimes I do think about that, where you talk about, you know, Laird, like, well, if he had kept writing volume 4 back when he was writing volume 4, it would be a different volume 4 than if he started writing volume 4 tomorrow. And that's the thing I always like lament about, where I'm like, you know, oh, if, you know, I don't know, like, you know, there's other books out there that are super unfinished. It's like, there's a dozen Kevin Smith books that have never been finished. You know, there's like Stephen Bissett's Tyrant, you know, that has never been finished. There's like all kinds of books where I'd be like, oh, that'd be cool if it was finished. And then, like, you know, there's some other stuff where I had heard, you know, Barry Windsor Smith's Monster talked about in hushed tones and secrets for years. And then eventually it finally did come out, and it was like, I guess I had nothing to compare it to. Like, I don't know that it would have been different had it, you know. I guess what I wonder is, what if those ideas had actually been incorporated into the Hulk comic instead of his graphic novel? Like, how would that have, like, changed the, you know, what alternate reality would Hulk comics look like had that gone forward way back then, or so, you know what I mean? Like, it, I don't know. I know it's like totally tangential and whatever, but it's just, it's fun to think about, like, how those things would, like, twist and turn, you know, what would have actually happened or dovetailed what ended up taking place.
It's like, sometimes you think, like, what Chris Claremont and Simon Furman wanted to do back in the day, like, would it have been Regeneration 1 and X-Men Forever? Like, it's like, would we forgive it if it came out back then? Like, probably, I don't know. Like,
yeah. Yeah, the aspect of, like, it's been gone for so long, so there's that thirst for it, so then maybe you're more forgiving of whatever it is. And if it was that, and people weren't as forgiving, would it have just gotten canceled, like, a year later instead of, like, when it got canceled? Like, those kind of, I don't know. Anyway, it's I don't know. It's probably pointless but fun to think about those things, I guess. I don't know. Are we missing anything about the issue proper that you guys want to discuss? I mean, as far as, like, you know, like, I don't know, like, reprints or alternate covers, or, you know, I you know, I don't know. I'm just trying to throw stuff out there and see if anything, you know, catches anybody's interest as far as, like, the issue proper itself. Like, I know I know they said that I know some people were like confused at like why was it printed in a magazine size, and I guess what I guess this is apocryphal, but what I had heard was when they took it to the printing press that they showed them a copy of TV Guide and went, oh, this is what we want, meaning they wanted a glossy outside cover that looked really nice, but that the inside was all newsprint, black and white. And they took that literally and made it the same size as TV Guide for those first four couple of issues. But I think, you know, the uncommunicated or the communication that was missing was, oh, we want it to look like this TV Guide, but comic sized. And eventually that, you know, came into play and happened, but it didn't actually, you know, start out that way, I guess, because of either omission or just, you know, miscommunication or something like that.
Dudes, it's totally time to listen to Fanholes.
What's that, Mikey?
Like only the most tubular, righteous, gnarly podcast ever.
I don't know, Mikey. I've got some science projects to work on.
Yeah, Mikey, and you know, some of the things those Fanholes say, you know, really ticks me off.
Well, why don't we see what Master Splinter has to say about listening to Fanholes?
Yeah, sure. Okay, Leo. But what do you think, Master Splinter? Should we listen to Fanholes, the pop culture podcast made for fans by the fans, or not? I say... Go, Fanholes! Go, Fanholes! Go! Ha, 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 ha! I made another funny! Ha, 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 ha!
All right. Well, if you guys have any comments, questions, and or concerns, if you're interested in some of the high concept, futuristic alternate reality stuff that we ended up dovetailing into the last half of the show, you can send us emails at fanholespodcast@gmail.com. We are on all kinds of social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Tumblr. We're on Twitter/X. We appreciate all the likes, hearts, shares, and retweets that we receive. We're over on Instagram. You know, you can see us over there. And we are we're basically you can now stream and or download the podcast. I mean, we're on Podbean. And then you can find us on whatever podcatchers currently exist at the given time. I'm not going to go through this shit again. And basically, like, so definitely, like, if you're on that podcatcher and you see Fanholes Podcast, go ahead and subscribe to that and check out all our other shows. So I think that's going to do it for tonight. So, and I guess if you want a direct download, just go to fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. And until the next time, this is going to be Derek WC, signing off.
Hey, it's Mike. Raph loves this stuff.
And this is Justin. I like turtles.
Turtles.
He likes turtles.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.